Miami Civics, not Miami Circus, heads to the national forefront. Obamacare heads to national unaffordability, and holiday travelers head to record national traffic. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll review this week's historic Miami mayoral election and preview its possible national repercussions after President Trump's endorsement loses in a landslide. We'll also look at the big local repercussions of the possible expiration of Obamacare subsidies, especially in the largest enrollment group here, Latinos. And we'll discuss how to navigate what's being forecast as unprecedented holiday travel volumes starting next week. Get your MIA on. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. This week, Miami made national headlines, but this time not because of the usual circus in City Hall, but because of the historic results in the voting booth. On Tuesday, Eileen Higgins was elected the first female mayor of the city of Miami, and her victory marked the first time in more than 30 years that a Democrat has won that office. Just as notable was that she defeated, by an almost 20-point landslide, the Republican candidate Emilio Gonzalez, who had been endorsed by President Trump. That, of course, has a lot of political pundits, not to mention a lot of optimistic Democrats, pointing to Miami as a harbinger of things to come in next year's national midterm elections. Higgins, after all, rode to victory on two issues especially hazardous for Trump and the GOP right now, affordability and immigration. What's more, Miami showed that Latino voters, a bloc that helped push Trump into the White House again, may be just as quickly backing away from him again. What's your take on the Miami election and other South Florida contests this week? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to assess what happened Tuesday night and what's likely to come are WLRN investigative reporter Daniel Rivero and our government accountability reporter Joshua Ceballos. Both have been covering this election as closely and expertly as anyone. Danny, Josh, how are you guys?
Doing well.
Good, thank you.
Long week.
Great, yes. Yes, but an interesting one. People are calling this a historic, even tectonic election for Miami. Not just the mayoral result, but other races too. Josh, let me start with you. What makes Tuesday such a potential turning point for this city, which in recent years we've frequently referred to as the Miami mess?
Yeah, I think the Miami mess was a big part of the campaign in this race.
Good point.
Both candidates talked about bringing order and efficiency back to City Hall and doing away with all of this political infighting, which has characterized the commission for many years now. Mm-hmm. You know, I've often pointed out, and Mayor-elect Higgins pointed out, that sometimes commissioners have almost gotten into fistfights. So I think people realize that this is a new era for Miami. There's no more political dynasties. The Carollos are out of the commission.
Right. And we're going to talk about that a little later in this conversation. Yeah.
The Suarez family is out of the mayorship. So this is all new blood on the commission. And there may be a chance to actually do something new in the city without all of the drama and mess.
Good point. Danny, your take. What makes this election such a watershed moment for a city that's been the embarrassing butt of national jokes, but is now suddenly a serious source of national conversation going into next year's midterms?
Yeah, I mean, to Josh's point, just the amount of new blood that's on the scene. And you know, there's a lot of other dynasties too, like the Diaz de la Portilla is out.
Yeah.
There's, for the first time in a really long time, there's no one in the Regalado family kind of in the picture. A Regalado tried to run for a commission seat earlier this year and lost. So I mean, it is kind of a brand new page. And you know, one of the things that Mayor-elect Higgins is talking about doing, which is a sharp contrast to what we've had recently, is she promises to actually be there in City Hall,
be more hands-on
mayor. Francis Suarez, the current mayor, and he does have people that have strong support on him. He does not have a reputation for being engaged.
Yeah.
He is a very much, there are people that have not seen him for weeks, if not months, in City Hall. He is generally not around. And, you know, that's one of the main things that the mayor-elect says is, I'm going to be in City Hall. So it could be a new day in
I want to discuss that a little further toward the end of our conversation as well, when we also discuss this end of the Carollo dynasty, for example. But let's give this election a more granular look, though. It seems three big issues helped give Eileen Higgins her landslide victory and Emilio Gonzalez his landslide loss, and they were affordability, immigration, and Miami's notorious corruption. Mm-hmm. Josh, let's start with affordability. And in many respects, for Miami voters, that means more affordable housing, which I know Higgins really pushed in her campaign. Here's what she said to you this week after the election along those lines.
So there's a number of ways that housing can be accelerated. Number one, we've talked about the terrible permitting system. Right now, it takes at least 2 years to permit a project to build, let's say, 100 affordable or workforce units. It can take less than 2 years to build that project. The bureaucracy cannot last longer than the construction.
So she's talking about Miami's notorious bureaucratic hurdles there, but how powerfully, Josh, did the housing and affordability issue drive her victory this week?
Well, I think affordability is top of mind for probably everyone in Miami. I spoke to voters during the primary and during the runoff. All of them talked about affordability, and it feels like you can't go anywhere in this county without hearing people talk about how expensive it is to live here.
Particularly for renters, right?
For renters. You know, the cost of living is insane. So,
And I mention that because Latinos, along with the Black community, disproportionately rent in this country and in this city.
Yes, and so both candidates did talk about affordability. That is the buzzword, I think, of this moment in national politics. But Eileen, I think, really brought it home because she has this legislative record that she can point to as a county commissioner.
County commissioner.
About, you know, pushing for affordable housing. And I think she's looking at it in a different way, and I think in a more granular way, fixing this permitting system, getting projects off the ground quicker. She also talked about taking an inventory of all the city-owned land, all the properties that the city owns, and seeing what they can do with that and how they can build affordable housing on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Danny, I know you were taking a special look at how immigration policy, meaning, of course, President Trump's severe immigration crackdown, and how it's affecting Miami communities like Cubans, how it influenced votes as well. Again, here's Mayor-elect Higgins talking with Josh about that.
When you look at the broader Miami-Dade County and temporary protected status, we have about 15% of our population estimated to have TPS. That's more or less about 300,000 people. Imagine if we lose 300,000 people, what our economy would be like. So we want a strong border. We want a path to citizenship. We don't want law-abiding people to be ejected from our country, impoverishing their family and driving our economy into ruin.
So she's referring there to programs like TPS that have protected migrants from deportation, but which the Trump administration is now canceling. But again, Danny, how strongly did anger over this issue drive Higgins' landslide win, especially when we consider the career background of her opponent, Emilio Gonzalez?
I mean, I don't think there's any way to get around a talk about immigration at any level of government at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone is connected. Miami is still a majority immigrant city. Mm-hmm. And those people come from all over the place. And let's talk about some of them. TPS, what's happening with TPS is happening. But also just last week, the Trump administration moved to essentially cancel swearing-in ceremonies for new U.S. citizens from Cuba,
yes. mm-hmm.
Venezuela, and Haiti. So you have people that have green cards here legally that now cannot become citizens until further notice.
I was getting phone calls late last week from immigration attorneys telling me that, for example, green card interviews had just been canceled.
If you want to set off alarm bells for people in a city like Miami, you do exactly that. I mean, immigration was an impossible thing to ignore in this. And you know, if you look at the city map, like the districts, I'm sorry, the precincts of how people voted, it is remarkably blue across the map in this last election. There are some parts of the city, the more suburban parts, that are still more conservative, that might more align with President Trump. But if you look really across the board, it was a sharp turn against the president, in large part because of immigration.
And we should point out, 2 days before the election, Miami Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar, right, our Republican, came out very harshly against this immigration process, paused the Trump administration, but she called it un-American and unfair. What kind of influence could that have had on voters' minds?
You know, okay, so I was on election night. I was at the watch party for Emilio Gonzalez, the conservative, mm-hmm, in this race, who did lose. And I was talking to a lot of Republicans at that party, and some of them told me pretty flatly, like, we're in trouble, guys. This is not good for Republicans, this, mm-hmm, this election outcome. There's a lot of nervousness about where that leads. You know, which direction do they go? Do they keep their foot on the pedal to the metal on, you know, hard crackdowns on immigration? Do they read the room? Do they ease up? Like, how do they do? They're kind of, they've thrown their lot in with heavy crackdown immigration mindset, mm-hmm, in a place like Southern Florida. You know, at some point, things start to shift and they break, or maybe you hit the breaking point. And I got some sense for talking to people, maybe we've gotten there.
And just quickly, I did mention, for example, Emilio Gonzalez's past career. I was talking about, right, his career in immigration, the immigration government bureaucracy. Could that have hurt him at all?
Right.
Because this issue was so large in the election.
I mean, he is someone who is deeply intimate with how this works. He was the head of USCIS, which anyone that goes through immigration knows they are literally the people that, mm-hmm, you know, give the green light for a green card or a work visa, citizenship, whatnot.
Yeah.
So he was intimately aware. And, you know, in one of the mayoral forums, he said he supports the Trump administration's policies, but if there's an issue with anyone in the community, he would make a call and kind of address it on a one-to-one basis because he, mm-hmm, knows the people at USCIS. Didn't work with voters, but he's very close to immigration historically.
Yeah, but we should point out, as a Republican, he's fairly moderate in terms of these
of course,
issues.
Yeah.
He's not what you would call a MAGA
Republican.
Him
and Eileen are actually very close on a lot of policies.
Yeah, agreed.
And, mm-hmm, and they both actually have a lot of respect for each other and have said so publicly.
Yeah.
So definitely not this firebrand.
Yeah, I have to admit, the debates between them were extraordinarily civil, mm, when you consider,
right,
what Miami's usual political, yeah, discourse is like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, you know, just to add to that, it was very civil. There was a lot of overlap in a lot of city municipal issues. But I think part of what we saw with the result here is Eileen Higgins has, you know, shown herself to be someone who might be willing to stand up in support of immigrants. And it's ironic. People really want that now. You know, Emilio Gonzalez is the immigrant, and he did not show himself as a candidate, yeah, as someone who would stand, mm-hmm, up in support,
right, because
of immigrants.
She, for example, said that she would not really work that hard to enforce this agreement between,
yeah,
local police enforcement or law enforcement and federal immigration authorities in terms of immigration enforcement, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, she said that because the city of Miami entered into a 287G agreement with,
right,
ICE, saying that the police department would
ICE
help.
ICE meaning Immigration and Customs,
right,
Enforcement.
And she said that there's no reason the city should have done that. And under her, she plans to make it so that they do as little as possible with that.
Right. That,
if not get out
that,
of it.
That could, yeah, have made a difference. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Daniel Rivero and Joshua Ceballos about this week's historic Miami mayoral election and its national repercussions, as well as other races here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So let's step back here a little and look at the national ramifications of this Miami election that everyone's talking about. As I mentioned, it makes sense because those two Miami issues we just discussed, affordability and immigration, promise to be key concerns in next year's national midterm elections. And that, of course, brings us to the question of how badly President Trump's endorsement may have hurt Emilio, mm-hmm, Gonzalez. Josh, how much should we read into this? How important is Miami now in this regard, especially when we're talking about the important Latino vote?
Well, I want to start by saying I received some feedback over the week, the past week, from some listeners who wanted to really dive into the Latino vote, because we should say it's not a monolith.
Well, of course not.
Especially,
yeah, right,
in Miami, mm-hmm, we have a lot of different migrant groups from a lot of different places that have different perspectives. Cubans, for instance, in my estimation, and I'm Cuban, don't see themselves as immigrants as much as, you know, say a Venezuelan or a Colombian population. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I think the immigration policies coming from the federal level have affected people from everywhere, you know, including Cubans. And so I think everyone's kind of feeling the hurt on that and maybe taking a turn. Latinos have predominantly voted for Trump in the last few elections. Hialeah was incredibly
for Trump. It's why Miami-Dade County went red in last year's presidential election.
So so the fact that this in district, the city's District 3, which includes Little Havana, it's a majority Hispanic district. Mm-hmm. Eileen Higgins, who is not Latina, won by 8 points. And she's the first non-Hispanic mayor in over 20 years. So this, I think this says something, especially since she's a Democrat and an out-and-out Democrat, you know, mm-hmm. I should say, like, waving the flag. The fact that she won in those districts means there could be an actual shift in the opinion of many Latino voters from various walks of life.
Nationwide, yeah. Danny, how about you? Do you think this Miami election actually bruised the Trump brand, especially in the same week, for example, when very red Indiana, where I'm from, also rebuked his orders to adopt a redistricted congressional map, for example? How angry is all this going to make the president, and can we expect some sort of retribution from him here?
You know, Miami, in a lot of ways in the last 5 years or so, has been used by President Trump as like, that's my city. Like, those are my people. He's really leaned into Miami as one of the few, really, truly few major cities in the U.S. Mm-hmm. that is a stronghold.
Despite the fact that Kamala Harris still beat him very narrowly in 2024 election in Miami. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, you know, Miami-Dade County overall, it's one of his few strongholds as a major metropolitan area. And that was bruised. You know, he's trying to put his presidential library in downtown Miami.
Yeah. Good point.
And you know, we are seeing, you know, across the country, like what you mentioned in Indiana, they refused his redistricting maps. People turning on him in some kind of way.
But you also mentioned that maybe we're seeing a little anger coming in the form of, for example, more ICE presence in places like Little Havana.
I was about to say, just this week, there has been a larger presence of ICE in places like Little Havana in the city of Miami, more than we've seen in the past. And we know whether there's a one-to-one connection because of election results, and this is, you know, a way to get back at Miami. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we have seen that this week after the election.
Yeah. Good point. Josh, let's look at the end of the Carollo dynasty that we mentioned earlier, especially the end of the Joe Carollo era. What most importantly does that mean for Miami in terms of their legacy and in terms of the city moving forward now?
Yeah, so just for listeners to know, Joe Carollo has been in city politics for almost 50 years. I wrote a story about that recently. And his brother, Frank Carollo, just lost an election for Joe's seat in District 3. So yeah, there's no Carollos in office for the first time in decades. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I think people, like on Trump, people were ready to turn a page. I've been covering Carollo for many years now, and there's always some kind of outrage against something that he's doing, whether that's in Bayfront Park or something in Little Havana, and people wanted a change. So what does this mean moving forward? I think there's going to be possibly a little bit more decorum in the city hall, because he was often getting into fights and arguing with public commenters and screaming at people, and I think the meetings are going to go a lot quicker because he won't be able to talk for 20 minutes. But I think there's actually going to be some substantive changes in District 3 in Little Havana and West Brickell. I think that could really happen.
And Danny, finally, in just the 30 seconds we have left, you mentioned that Eileen Higgins promises to be at least a more engaged mayor than Francis Suarez proved to be. And again, we're talking about the end of the Suarez dynasty, really. His father, Xavier Suarez, was a former mayor here. If she does prove to be that more engaged and effective mayor, does that maybe argue for renewed efforts to create a stronger mayor in Miami's city charter?
You know, I think we're going to have to really wait and see on results on this one. I mean, one thing she does say is the mayor can run the city commission meetings by charter. They can if they show up. Francis Suarez, I think we can count with one hand how many times he actually showed up and did that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She says she is going to do that. She's going to be full-time mayor, no outside employment. very much in every way the contrast of Francis Suarez. Okay. So we'll have to see, you know, what actually happens in the coming months and years. Really.
All right. Daniel Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Joshua Ceballos is our government accountability reporter. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Still to come, more than 1 million South Floridians rely on Obamacare. Can they afford it anymore? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. If you rely on Obamacare for health insurance coverage, yesterday was probably disappointing. The U.S. Senate shot down a Democratic bill that would have extended tax credits or subsidies for Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, for 3 more years. It also rejected Republican legislation that would have created an ACA alternative in the form of health care savings accounts. Either way, it's looking like the ACA subsidies will expire on January 1st. That means affordability will also expire as Obamacare premiums skyrocket for the almost 25 million Americans enrolled in it. Latinos are among the largest Obamacare beneficiary groups. In fact, the zip code with the nation's highest number of enrollees is in Hialeah. And that, of course, means South Florida, where more than 1 million people use Obamacare, stands to be heavily affected by the disappearance of those subsidies. Meanwhile, Obamacare critics say the subsidies were just too big a drain on taxpayer funds. Will you be unable to afford Obamacare after January 1st? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Paul Velez. He's president and CEO of Borinquen Medical Centers here in Miami-Dade County. Most of those facilities' patients are Latinos and Haitians. Paul, great to have you on again.
Thank you, Tim. Great introduction. Great to be back, as always. And what perfect timing where we are right now.
Well, yeah, this is definitely timely. And we should mention that Borinquen is the indigenous name for Puerto Rico. So that gives our listeners some idea of the community origins of your medical centers, correct?
Right. We were established in 1972. We opened for services to the community in 73, and that is absolutely correct.
But Paul, let's start with your reaction to the Senate's failure yesterday to resolve this Obamacare subsidies crisis. What's your sense of how this is going to end up now?
I wish I had a crystal ball, but I can tell you one thing. I don't have a magic wand, but I don't think the president nor anyone in Congress or in the Senate want to see the subsidies expire. Even the president said yesterday evening at an event that I caught before on my way to work was that we got to work with the Democrats. So me personally, I don't see this as a political issue. I see this as a human rights issue because Affordable Care Act allows more people to get the care they need and deserve. And as you said in the prior interview, about 10 minutes ago, this is about 25 million folks that would be without any access at all. And and check this out. The impact would be huge on community health centers across the nation.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a healthcare executive and administrator, how badly do you see Obamacare premiums spiking next year if these tax credits really do expire on January 1st? How large a healthcare insurance burden increase are we going to see on the shoulders of patients like those you serve at Borinquen?
Well, without the Affordable Care Act, you know, the ACA, thousands of families in our community would lose the ability to see a doctor, as I said earlier. When you abolish the Affordable Care Act, you would be hitting vulnerable communities the hardest. You know, working families, seniors, people with chronic conditions, and also people who cannot afford to move backwards on access to care. And one important thing, primary healthcare centers have very limited secondary kind of care, the hospital care, where you can be able to get not just primary, but secondary and tertiary care. Uh-huh. And what I mean by that are surgical procedures. We do very minimal procedures like that in our OBGYN department, but What's going to happen to those folks who have existing chronic ailments and they have hospitalization visits being put on hold because the uncertainty of who's going to pay the bill?
Yeah.
You see, that's the problem.
Well, let's look specifically at South Florida, Paul. The rates of the health care uninsured already exceed the state average, 16.7% in Miami-Dade County, 15% in Broward, and about 16% in the Keys, for example. How much worse will the loss of Obamacare subsidies make that situation in this community?
It could be quite infinite because we don't know. But what I can say is that when we look at the numbers, when you look at the enrollment, and you look at the amount of folks, because we have specialized staff that provide enrollment guidance, and we help patients to be eligible, hoping they can qualify. Because remember, managed care is run by private for-profit companies.
Yeah.
And no one has said anything yet about, they don't want to be, these big corporate entities don't want to lose, not millions of dollars, but billions of dollars, because no one is really seeing how our mission is to serve the community, and we have a mission to be able to serve, as I said. But how do you deal with the billions and perhaps trillions of dollars if we don't have a plan in place? Mm-hmm. And then what's going to be unaffordable will be healthcare.
Yeah, I'm glad you point that out. It's not just patients who are going to be feeling the pain of this. It's also companies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about the Uniteds, the Meritain, which is a subsidiary. We were talking about the Humanas. You know, I'm not plugging anybody. But I'm saying these are some of the big, big corporate giants. And I'm sure they don't want to be losing money because they're going to be reimbursed back.
Yeah.
And another issue is that where it comes to ACA, hospitals and centers, we all rely because they are the very folks that work with the hospitals and deal with policy and stuff like that. Yeah.
What are you, speaking of that, what are you and the Boring Cane Medical Centers hearing from your patients about this? And what are you telling them in response to their fears and concern about what's potentially coming, especially in heavy Obamacare related pockets like Hialeah, for example, that I mentioned earlier?
We have patients that travel all over South Florida, but the patients, they're very worried, obviously. You know, they're concerned about what's going to happen to their specialists or referrals to specialists. And again, what's going to happen is that if there is the abolishment of the Affordable Care Act, ACA, then there would be huge, huge challenges to meet the expectations to provide our care, because we do work, we do accept most insurances, Tim, but mm-hmm. we also have, which is what's called a sliding fee discount scale.
Right.
And we have to have this approved by HRSA, you know, and so we know we're going to continue to provide to the community.
And please, if you could remind us what HRSA means.
Health Resources Services Administration.
Exactly, right, okay.
And the parent company on top of that is HHS, mm-hmm. where a secretary, you know, Kennedy is the secretary.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Paul Velez of the Boring Cane Medical Centers about the local impact of the possible expiration of Obamacare subsidies at the end of the year. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Paul, I know you're not a politician, but the politics of this crisis can't be ignored. I want to play two clips here where we hear politicians assigning partisan blame. First is South Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
The ball is in Republicans' court. If we don't extend those tax credits, the explosive increase in health care costs will be in Republicans' lap. And it doesn't have to be that way. People deserve better.
And here's a Republican response to that from GOP Senator John Barrasso from Wyoming.
Mr. President, Obamacare has failed so badly that Democrats continue to use taxpayer dollars to try to hide the failures.
So the partisan argument seems to boil down to the Democrats saying the Obamacare subsidies have to continue because the Republicans haven't offered a viable alternative in spite of this health care savings account proposal. And the Republicans saying the Democrats want us to keep throwing taxpayer money at an Obamacare system that's flawed and needs reform. As a healthcare CEO, Paul, do you think they both have a point, let's say? And if so, how does your industry navigate these two seemingly intractable stances?
Again, skipping the politics, we want to continue to serve the community. Now, the impact where it gets political, and it's unfortunate because there was a lot of expansion during George W. Bush's term as president for 8 years and also when Obama became president. So what we have been implementing, or what has been in existence, was actually a Republican concept, became a reality when a former governor of Massachusetts, and we're talking about a Republican governor who supported a very, it's very similar what is known as the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and okay? that governor, Massachusetts governor, was whom?
He ran for president. Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was Obama became president, and there was a commitment at that time to Senator Ted Kennedy before he passed away to honor this. And again, we were one of the first senators that went live. We had Secretary Sebelius here the week before. So we were basically in the right neighborhood at the right place at the right time where it came to having the go live. And a lot of folks remember what happened that day. The whole system went down, and that was ugly. And we had to. So it took a number of days, as you may recall, for us to get on path. I wanted to share, when you have 25 million folks being able to see a doctor, what is wrong with that? See, what is right with it is that you want to be able to have a healthy nation.
Sure.
We had to experience three to 4 years, even in post COVID, and a lot of folks perished and died because they didn't have access to health care. Mm-hmm. And we've always prided ourselves as a federally qualified health center that we provide or deliver affordable quality health care, mm-hmm. because we have to have measures in which we measure quality. Community health centers have monthly finance committee meetings. We have monthly board meetings. So we're held to a higher authority, Tim, and we are doing the right things, but we need the resources. If there's going to be another plan, it has to be shown or that it's going to be efficient, but not lose the quality and not decrease.
Right.
But I'm sorry.
No. But I mean, talking about other plans, I'm glad you brought that up. So what then is the healthcare industry itself, companies like Boehring Kane, for example, what are you advising the politicians to do to salvage this situation? Are there any compromises you and the private sector see that the folks in Washington are missing and perhaps need to consider?
Well, I think we need to eliminate the politics and the name calling. You know, we work with both sides of the aisle for many years, and I have many good colleagues and friends that work on both sides and their staff. It's a shame that we can't look and say, listen, we know our healthcare system would need an infusion of resources because we're still not there where it comes to providing access across. And Tim, it's not just the United States. It's also other U.S. territories, including Puerto Rico. We're talking about Guam, mm-hmm. you know, the
U.S. Virgin Islands. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a few. But the point is, what is out? I want to see, and many of us would like to see, what is being offered so we can be able to compare, evaluate, and take the best of whatever and come up. But that's not happening yet.
Okay.
And the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, hey man, January 1st is the key thing. So what are we going to do?
Well, Paul, in just the 30 seconds we have left here, do you fear that if those Obamacare subsidies expire, we're just going to see a lot of people say, I'm just going to go without medical insurance and hope they don't get sick?
That's probably what's going to happen. My daughter's former babysitter was having Florida Blue at $45. I told her to check to see what the new rates are. It's like $187. So imagine, it's not, we're not talking about a 100% increase, but we're talking about increases that could be 500 to 1,000%. I'm speculating only because we don't know what the new rates are and what would be in the future. So I can just say that. In closing, Borinquen, our mission is to continue to care for everyone, Tim, and we're preserving the Care Act is essential to protecting the health and dignity of our community.
Paul Velez is president and CEO of the Borinquen Medical Centers. Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, traveling for the holidays, let's talk about the record traffic you're likely facing. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The travel watchdog AAA is forecasting record road and air traffic for the holidays starting next week. Between December 20th and January 1st, more than 122 million Americans look set to get in planes, trains, and automobiles, and buses, too. That's a 2% increase from last year's record. Almost 90% of them will be in their cars, but an unprecedented number are expected in the skies as well, meaning this could also be a record test of all of our Christmas, Hanukkah, and New Year's cheer. That's especially true since Miami International Airport, for example, is in the midst of a $9 billion renovation. Just keep telling yourself, MIA means modernization in action. Even so, MIA and Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International are offering handy new parking options as their garages fill up faster than economy class to Atlanta. And hey, at least we don't have to take our shoes off anymore at the TSA security checkpoints. Are you planning to travel for the holidays? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now here in the studio is someone who watches the travel gauntlet especially closely for this community. Vinod Sriharsha covers travel and tourism for the Miami Herald. Vinod, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Vinod, for all intents and purposes, I think we can say we've been in holiday travel mode since Thanksgiving. And I hear you picked up your mom yesterday at Miami International Airport. So why don't we start there and tell me where she was coming from and what you saw as we move into the really heavy days next week?
I did. Thanks for asking. She was flying in from the Bay Area on a nonstop flight and landed about 30 minutes ahead of schedule.
Wow.
But didn't get to the gate for another 20 minutes. So that's the dilemma of arriving early.
Uh-huh.
It worked out for me because I was still on the Dolphin Expressway on the way to the airport as I saw lanes start to close. And that reminded me, I forgot about the construction going on, and I think listeners ought to remember now, if you have to go to MIA around, you know, close to 10 p.m. or at night, you know, leave yourself extra time because of the overpass construction on the Dolphin Expressway.
Good pair.
They're closing down the lanes at night, so but then I got there on time.
So maybe like take Lejeune, for example, if you're,
you're
looking for an alternative
that would be an option, or just, you know, leave like an extra 20-30 minutes early. I got there to the airport before she got to baggage claim, you know, Concourse D, the arrival section. It's, you know, it's still pretty crowded, pretty congested. You know, looking forward to the baggage claims area being modernized because I think that's something that could use.
And that's part of this $9 billion renovation, right?
Yeah. Right.
So let's take a little closer look at that epic $9 billion renovation project MIA is undergoing, which you pointed out in a recent article won't really be finished until 2039. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think most of it will be finished a few years earlier, but the entirety of the, you know, will not be done until then.
So can you walk us through the good MIA news for holiday travelers this year? Like, for example, I know TSA Checkpoint 2, you've reported, has been upgraded. The SkyTrain is finally working again, so the walk from gate D60 to the terminal is no longer the Bataan death march. And what's the not-so-good news they'll face in terms of ongoing construction? Give us the good and the bad.
Well, the good is there's a new parking garage opening up, and then going back to, actually on December 19th, going back to the TSA checkpoint you mentioned, it's not just the shoes that you get to keep on right now if you go through TSA checkpoint too. It's you don't have to take your laptops out of your bags anymore or other electronic devices. So they've got like an upgraded 3D CT image scan that scans for explosives. And, you know, a lot of other cities across the country have this, but at MIA, this is the first checkpoint that, you know, it was checkpoint 2 was out of service for, I think, a little over a month, and since November 1st, it's had that new technology.
Now, is this going to be all lane? Because my experience has been this year is like it's kind of a crapshoot. Sometimes I'm in a lane where they say, do take out your laptop. Sometimes I'm in one that says you can keep your laptop in. Does this mean now that all lanes will not require laptops to have to go into the bins?
At checkpoint 2, that's correct.
Two.
There are, I think, four lanes at checkpoint 2, and each of those have the new screen, have the new CT machine. So yeah, you'll be able to keep your electronics in your bag, and basically the bins are much larger, so you can put like everything in one bin, and yeah, it seems to be moving pretty quickly.
Now, I mentioned the SkyTrain, but I know from your reporting we're also seeing a real improvement with things like the escalators and elevators that were a big complaint from travelers in years past, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think they recognize that, you know, that's one of the biggest issues that travelers, you know, your listeners, our readers have, is, you know, the conveyance, the elevators, escalators, moving walkways. And that's been a big issue. And I think they're up to, they sent me some new numbers just for your listeners, and they're up to, I think, 94% of conveyances that are working and are in order as of today. So I think
that is good news. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, travelers should just expect to see some of them, you know, out of order. You know, and if you see a lot more than 6% not working, you know, let Tim or myself know, because we'll need to stay on top of that.
But when we're talking about the ongoing construction, what are some of your best tips for travelers and people picking up travelers for navigating MIA in the coming days and weeks? Any shortcuts, anything they should make sure to try to avoid as we get into the heavy days?
I mean, if you can go in the mornings or even before noon, I find that to be kind of the quiet, you know, pretty quiet there. Even, you know, when I've traveled during the holidays during what I thought would be busy days, but the morning was pretty quiet. Even during the government shutdown, know, I went there several times and looked at the TSA lines, and, you know, I think the lines were never that long. When the TSA checkpoint 2 got reinstalled, it reopened, I think there was a line of like maybe 25, 30 people tops, and then that moved quickly. So mornings are good. If you can, you know, avoid having to park there, that's always good. Still getting there early is...
Are you finding that, for example, my wife and I have found that Ubering back and forth to MIA, if we're going on a week-long trip or something, for example, that Ubering is less expensive than parking in the Flamingo or Dolphin garages for a week at MIA, if you can find a space. But you said the good news is we're going to see new parking facilities at MIA. But are you finding that people are looking for alternatives to having to park at MIA?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually finding Uber to be more expensive than taxis. I mean,
I would agree with that, definitely. Yeah.
I take Uber a lot in the city, but the one place I don't take it is when I'm at MIA. I opt for taxis, and I find them to be cheaper and just easier.
Really?
Easier to find, because, you know, the...
Yeah, they're right there, all lined up for you.
Yeah, and the arrivals... I mean, there's not a great system still to get Ubers.
That is a good point, yeah. That is still... That can be difficult, no doubt about it. But bottom line, and I'm glad you mentioned the government shutdown just a second ago, bottom line, in the wake of that, are South Florida's airports, and again, I include FLL as well as MIA, are they ready for that record holiday crush we described at the outset? And should we expect more people here leaving South Florida for the holidays, or maybe, or more people coming in to South Florida for the holidays? But again, bottom line, are our two major airports here ready for what's coming after we just went through with the government shutdown?
I think, you know, the good news is that during the government shutdown, they fared pretty well. FLL, I remember the day that, I think, the day of the six, you know, if you remember, the FAA imposed flight reductions of up to 10%, but they never got to 10%. The max was 6%. But even when it was 6%, FLL never had cancellations near 6%.
Okay.
MIA didn't either. I mean, MIA had like 1.5% of its flights canceled. And, you know, Cirium, which is an aviation analytics firm, actually had them at the lowest cancellation rate among 21 airports during, like, on one of the days of the shutdown. So I think they fared pretty well. There were no, like, you know, there were no major sick outs by, you know, TSA officials or FAA folks at MIA. You know, Ralph Coutier has made it a point to, you know, to indicate that. So, you know, they fared pretty well. And yeah, they're going to, you know, I think they're ready.
That's good news. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Vinod Sriharsha about navigating what's set to be record holiday travel traffic. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Vinod, what about non-air travel? As I mentioned earlier, AAA expects almost 90% of that record holiday travel we're likely to see between now and the new year to be on the road, not in the sky. Anything to warn travelers about when they get in their cars or board all those buses and trains? I know Amtrak opened new service between Miami and Washington, D.C. and Chicago this year, right? I mean, can we expect more people to use that option or options like it?
Yeah, I think so. But I think, you know, there's going to be pretty heavy road traffic. And, you know, it's not, in all honesty, it's not something I cover closely. But I think if you look at the AAA numbers, there are a lot more people who are going to hit the roads rather than hit the skies, I mean, including in Florida. So I would say, you know, kind of try to pick, you know, try to pick places that aren't, you know, that aren't as popular and, you know, aren't going to draw big crowds and away, you know, away from tourists.
Finally, Vinod, in just the minute we have left here, I don't think we can talk about holiday travel this year without also discussing affordability. What are travelers seeing in terms of fares, especially airfares and hotel rates, which of course matters a lot when we're talking about holiday travel into South Florida destinations, say like Miami Beach?
Hotel rates have come down. Airfares are, I think, have come down very, very slightly. So it's still, you know, it's still not super cheap. But people who are coming into South Florida, I think, you know, are going to find hotels with slightly lower prices than a year from now. You know, remember, tourism overall has taken a bit of a hit, even in through the first half of this year at MIA and FLL.
Good point. Vinod Sriharsha covers travel and tourism for the Miami Herald. Vinod, many thanks and happy holidays, and have a great time with your mom here.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks to you, and happy holidays to your listeners.
Thank you. Finally on the roundup, valiente, valiente, meaning courageous in Spanish. That was a crowd welcoming Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado in Oslo Wednesday night. She just finished a courageous odyssey from hiding in Venezuela, across the Caribbean to Maine in the U.S., and across the Atlantic to Norway, where they presented her Nobel Peace Prize for heading Venezuela's courageous democracy movement. The question now, though, is whether Machado's nonviolent effort to restore democracy in Venezuela can be achieved without the violence of a U.S. military offensive against dictator Nicolas Maduro's brutal regime. Machado herself seemed unsure when she was asked about it in Oslo.
Democracy is the system that enables peace in a society. But you cannot have democracy without freedom.
Whenever and however that freedom comes, this week was a reminder that it starts with peaceful freedom fighters. Oswaldo Payá in Cuba, Nelson Mandela in South Africa, and Maria Corina Machado in Venezuela. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Jimena Romero. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.